Welcome to another special episode of the Oncology on the Go podcast, hosted by Daniel C. McFarland. In this episode, Dr. McFarland sat down with Kalena Chilcote, an expert in hospice and palliative care, to discuss the intersection of personality disorders and cancer. The pair touched on crucial topics, including understanding the stress patients with oncology face, assessing personality disorders in oncology, managing boundaries and expectations between the patients and providers, and addressing manipulative behavior. Overall, an emphasis on consistent care, clear communication, and maintaining a positive relationship with patients underscored their discussion.
Thank you for listening, everyone. I'm Dr. McFarland, and I'm joined by Dr. Chilcote today. And we have a really exciting topic. We're going to talk about personality disorders and cancer. And the reason I think this is such a crucial topic is because if we step back and think about the place and the frame in which we see our patients, I think it's fair to say most folks are under duress. It's very stressful meeting an oncologist. And, you know, we get to know obviously all sorts of different kinds of people. And frankly, I think that's one of the main reasons we go into this applied science of oncology, to apply our awareness of oncologic science to patients. And so the latter half of that equation are the patients themselves. And so that can be challenging. And so we have all heard the term a difficult patient, you know, quote unquote. And really, I think unfairly, patients will sort of get lumped into a category like that. Essentially kind of means we are not quite sure how to think about them, how to approach them appropriately, etc. Or it could also just mean that in some way their personality is kind of getting in the way of what we want to do. And oftentimes when I'm meeting with patients, I might see that they're struggling a little bit to navigate the oncology world, get done what they need to get done. I may even say to them, just in terms of kind of normalizing and validating what they're going through, that it's not only a logistical challenge. I think it's important to note that the things that we put our patients through, you know, are almost coercive. I mean, we, you know, everyone has a choice, right? But is it really a fair choice? They get appointments at certain times. They've got to see a lot of different clinicians, get different kinds of procedures. And cancer is never convenient. It never comes at a time when people are, you know, ultimately or appropriately prepared for what they're about to go through. So that's what I mean when I say we meet people when they're under duress. If you were to meet me when I was waiting to do something at the DMV, you may not like me very much. Or similarly, under some other kind of stressful situation. And patients really might not put their best foot forward with us. I mean, I think we can all kind of acknowledge that that happens from time to time, and we do our best. But what we're really going to focus on today is kind of the inner workings of this thing that we call personality. It's everything that kind of makes up ourselves. And so I just want to start off by saying that the selves that patients give us in the oncology clinic is by definition under stress. And so what we want to understand is how to work with these selves in a way that will help them, would ultimately enable them to get the care that we want to give to them. And so, thankfully, I'm joined by an expert in psycho-oncology, Dr. Chilcote, and we are going to discuss what this whole personality stuff is made of, and how it applies to oncology. So, without further ado, I want to start off with my very first question for her, which is simply, what is a personality disorder and how does it maybe differ from just personality, quote unquote, or personality style?
Thank you. And thank you for having me. I'm excited to talk about this topic. I agree. It's very important that we all understand where our patients are coming from and what they're bringing to the table when we meet them in such a challenging set of circumstances. I'm going to give a disclaimer before I answer that question that I don't actually think there's a perfect consensus about how we conceptualize personality or even how we think about personality disorders. If you ask different kinds of providers, even within the field of mental health, you may get subtly different answers to this. In psychiatry, most clinical providers do use the DSM diagnostic criteria. That's the Diagnostic Statistical Manual. It gives us a list of diagnostic criteria for all of our mental health diagnoses. And I think it's helpful to use that frame, you know, to think about our personality disorders. These are disorders that are a few things. They're enduring, they're inflexible, and they're pervasive. So they are consistent across time. They don't change considerably. And they occur in lots of different environments with different kinds of people. You know, it's not just in one specific place or with one specific person. And these are a pattern of an inner experience and the behaviors that we sometimes see that deviate markedly from what's expected within someone's culture. So it does require us to understand a bit about the culture that people come from and live within. And people have to meet criteria, have to have challenges in 2 out of 4 criteria. So trouble with what they call cognition in the DSM, which is really the way that somebody sees themselves and the people around them and the events that happen in their lives and how those interact. The second is affectivity, so emotional affectivity, interpersonal functioning, and then impulse control. And part of what sets that as a disorder rather than just the way someone is that it has to have some sort of negative impact, right? Has to lead to distress on the behalf of the patient, or it has to lead to impairments. So it impacts school, work, our relationships, maybe our engagement in healthcare.
Mm-hmm. The first thing you said about cognition, I think, is really key, that the person may not have an accurate perception of how they relate to those around them or how those around them might see them. So it's kind of not cognition how we normally think about it, but a form or some part of cognition, I guess.
Yeah.
Then personality, we kind of talk about it like, oh, I like this person's personality, or this personality is sort of difficult. And I think one of the other key things you said was this enduring, pervasive thing. We're meeting everyone sort of cross-sectionally. How do you assess that sort of thing, right? Like I have someone I'm meeting, they seem kind of adversarial or difficult in some way. What might you like be thinking of? How do you assess if it's enduring?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think sometimes we have the privilege of being able to get other information, right? We may be able to talk to friends or family. They may be present and openly offering descriptions of what they've observed over time. We may have lots of information in the chart where we can look back and see patterns. And sometimes patients can describe a lot of this to us too, right? You may pick up on little things. So if we think, like, just pick one of these, interpersonal functioning, we may hear patients say that they're estranged from some of their family members, or they've had some conflict at work. And, you know, they give us some hints about these symptoms in the way that they talk about their daily lives. And if we're listening for that, it's actually a lot easier to pick up on some of this and get a sense of where that's been over time.
Yeah.
I also would suggest, I'm not totally sure it matters. Mm. What I mean by that is that, you know, when you're an oncologist or a palliative medicine doctor and you're trying to help patients engage in their care, we're going to manage the symptoms, right? And in this case, the symptoms are the way that people think about things and the way that their behavior comes out in their interactions, how they engage with their care and with their team. And regardless of whether or not someone meets criteria for a diagnostic code on paper, we're still going to manage what we're hearing from people and what we're seeing. And it that may be the most important thing.
Right. No, that's a great. And I, you know, the other thing I like about what you said was this kind of way that it's tied to culture and environment. And so in terms of that aspect of just managing it, you know, it's sort of ripe for questions. Like, tell me about yourself. Are you finding this stressful? How do you normally do things under stress? And who's around you? You know, that those kinds of like basic questions can be really enlightening.
I love the one, Daniel. I love, like, what's the most stressful thing you've went through in the past before cancer? How did you get through that? What was that like? What helped you? What made that more difficult? Right, that can give you a lot too in those same, that same line.
Yeah. No, that I do like that too, because you're trying to get to know, you know, someone's strengths. And so we're not just looking at like, what's wrong, but what, you know, where can they succeed? Where are they best able to kind of adapt? And, you know, if you think about it, like you take someone out of what might be us, you know, their day-to-day situation, they may have never had any interaction with the healthcare system, and you put them in this really intense environment, and they have to sort of survive. It's like a sink or swim sort of thing. And, you know, my understanding of personalities is that, you know, there's some, when we think about, okay, well, this one's sort of adaptable and flexible, and then others aren't. And those that aren't probably work really well in some other environments, you know, but probably not this environment if you're, you know, kind of seeing that kind of conflict. The other thing is, I guess what you're saying is that making a quote unquote diagnosis is probably challenging. I mean, because you do need to, you know, hit those sort of DSM criteria and things like that. That's probably a little beyond the pale, but we're kind of saying, all right, well, we just want to know how to, you know, work with someone irrespective of what the diagnosis is. Do you think it's fair to talk about personality styles, or what would you make of that? Like, do we need to, because you also mentioned there's different, not just the DSM, but different ways that we might think about this sort of categorically, or should we even think about it categorically? Like, what would you make, if I want to communicate to someone that I'm having a tough time with a patient, like what's the best way for me to do that? Because I don't want to just sort of off the bat say, well, they have a personality disorder, right? So I guess in that context, what do you have any?
How we would communicate amongst each other as a medical
team? Yeah, I'm wondering about this, you know, difficult patient. I think is, you know, I think it can be kind of used pejoratively, and it can be unfair because it's sort of like, well, why is it difficult? Is it difficult for you, or is there something about the patient? So is there a way that we could be like more descriptive or more helpful when we're encountering someone who's struggling for whatever reason, you know, that it's a matter of, you know, someone's struggling to get their needs met. I mean, it could be that they could have financial difficulties, or they could have a difficulty actually cognitively understanding what needs to be done, right?
Yeah.
But we're saying this is difficulty on another level. It's difficulty on a kind of interpersonal operating level, you know, of like something is going. So how do we communicate about that in a way that will garner the help that they need? Like if I'm an oncologist and I've got someone who I'm worried about for this reason, you know, we kind of all do a sort of wink, wink, nod, nod, like, hey, you know, watch out for this one sort of thing. I don't know that I mean, yeah. Can we do better?
Of course we can. Of course. I mean, you're right. There's a fair amount of stigma around the label of a personality disorder diagnosis, right? And patients often know that. They're aware of that if someone's talked to them about it in the past or they've done some reading. We particularly see this, I think, with things like borderline personality disorder, or now more and more about narcissistic personality disorder, because there's a fair amount of talk about narcissism kind of in pop culture and on social media too. I think a descriptive approach is always helpful, because you're right. Having a personality disorder, like meeting the criteria for that, doesn't mean you're going to be a difficult patient. These are right. Can be very different things. I think it's kind of like a Venn diagram. You've got these overlapping circles, and there's some stuff that overlaps in the middle. There certainly are folks who can be a little challenging to work with. Some of those thought processes, the way they see themselves, some of the challenges they've had for a really long time can make it really hard for them to engage in meaningful ways, effective ways. And so they can be more challenging and take more time and resources. But there are also lots of people on the edges, right? And the other parts of the circle who aren't in that middle section, and we wouldn't label the same ways. And I think that's important to remember. I would suspect, you know, if we really like took a hard line and took a whole bunch of patients out of an oncology clinic and made them look through all the diagnostic criteria, probably some of the folks listening, their favorite patients would actually meet criteria for a personality disorder. And they may be surprised to learn that. I know many of my favorite patients meet criteria on paper. So, you know, that certainly happens. We just don't label it that way. So if we can take a more descriptive approach, particularly in our notes, when now that we're in an age where patients have access to the notes we write about them, I think describing is often a lot more helpful because it's a little easier to hear and it's more fact-based with less judgment associated, right? So I may describe what I've observed and maybe in my terms, but I think that goes a lot further with people. And I also try to have more communication with oncology teams about patients that are in this group, because I do think it's helpful in a staff message or something that's kind of a little more separated from the classic chart to talk about what's happening in a more open language too.
Hey, you brought up so many great points there. You know, I'm thinking about, you know, as we get to know our patients, it's pretty routine that we might ask something about, you know, what does your support system look like? Who's around you? So we're already kind of naturally getting to know their relationships and, you know, are they solid? Are they healthy? Or is there some dysfunction? And kind of what's that pattern like, you know? And so, you know, it wouldn't be too much of a stretch to go further and say, well, you know, how do you do best in relationships? I mean, this is essentially a relationship of a different kind. And they may have some real insight into that. And so that may be something that could be communicated too. Like we communicate patients' values and things like that. So,
and not just relationships in their personal lives. I ask patients a lot, like, who on your team do you have the greatest connection with? Who do you trust the most? Right? If I can see which of their providers they're really connecting with, I can always ask, like, what is it about that person that you feel so trusting? How? Because maybe we can build on that too.
The other thing, I'm not sure everyone's had this experience, but it's really enlightening if you have that, you know, we kind of talk about it as if patients don't know what we're talking about. But there are, like, for example, in borderline personality disorder, especially if someone's had dialectical behavioral therapy, they learn a real language around, you know, how to communicate their emotions. And so you'll meet folks who are very forthcoming about it. And I always find that just sort of like a wonderful thing. I mean, it's obviously because they've done a lot of work and that should be, you know, lauded and congratulated. But, you know, also just how wonderful it is that they're able to just basically describe, you know, what they need. And so I guess I just point that out because it's not always that we have that luxury, but it kind of gives you some amazing contrast when we do, in a sense of like, this is actually what's sort of possible, right? And so, you know, along those lines, I think it might be helpful to just like describe exactly what are the different, you know, there's like those three different kind of categories in the DSM, and you know, knowing like that there aren't really clear, we say, well, this person, you know, has borderline personality disorder, that this, that, and the other, but they're not clear usually, right? They're always like, they're a little murky. But the categories themselves, I think, are helpful to understand. Don't you, Kalina?
Like, absolutely. Yeah. It's a good way to conceptualize different patterns of thought, right? Yeah. And I think this does fit along with what you were just talking about people who find some comfort in their diagnosis, actually, and relate to that. So you're right. In the DSM, there are three clusters, we call them, the categories. Cluster A is what's called like kind of the odd or eccentric cluster. That includes paranoid, schizoid and schizotypal personality disorders. Cluster B is the one you may think about the most, what they call dramatic or erratic. So this is like antisocial, borderline, and narcissistic personality disorders. And then cluster C are the more anxious or fearful group. And that includes avoidant, dependent, and obsessive compulsive personality disorders. And then of course, there's kind of like, there's like a catch-all diagnosis, personality disorders, NOS kind of thing. And there's also a personality disorder due to a medical condition that you sometimes see get used in oncology for things mm-hmm. like frontal lobe brain tumors and stuff that don't fall in those clusters.
Mm-hmm. I do think that's helpful because, you know, I think we can all think back on patients who sort of relate to the world in one of these ways of either, you know, hey, they're hypervigilant, they're kind of paranoid, someone's going to get something over on me, or someone for whom, you know, a relationship develops too fast and it just sort of makes you feel like, what's this about? Or someone who's just always putting up barriers and walls and you're not really sure what that's about and, you know, how, to what degree do you knock those walls down, you know? And so patients often tell you what they kind of need. And so, okay, good. And so, and for some of these, we have like I mentioned DBT, like we have pretty clear kind of treatment paradigms and things like that, which is, I think, important to think about when it's like really sort of pervasive. So, okay. So thinking about those categories, like how, I'll ask you the big question of, you know, how do they develop? Who quote unquote gets a personality disorder and why?
I don't have a perfect answer to this question, but I have some ideas.
Okay.
You know, we certainly know that there's some genetic component to the development of personality disorders. We have some twin studies that show that. Mm-hmm. We also know there's probably some biological component. You know, they have done studies that show that folks that meet criteria for personality disorders may have differences in their serotonin pathways in the brain. They may have differences in some of the signaling from the amygdala. You know, there's some stuff there that we have started to explore, and there's lots more to be done in that realm. We also know that there are some environmental components, for lack of a better word. Like our experiences, particularly in early life, are important and can play a role in how we start to see ourselves and see ourselves within the world around us, how we relate to that world that's happening around us. So there's probably some combination of all of those things happening to lead to this development.
Yeah, no, that's a great answer. I wish I knew more about the basic science behind it, but I tend to lean to that latter category of, you know, it's a little more nurture than nature. That can also just be helpful in kind of understanding where the person's coming from and give you some clue as to where these sensitive points might be. Everyone wants to feel understood, you know, so there's that. And we hear some stuff that's, you just may not guess, you know, you may not guess that this is kind of what someone's actually gone through. That leads a little bit to this question I told you I was going to ask about. I know it always comes up. Is there a personality disorder that's prone to get cancer?
Yeah, I mean, certainly I hear this question from people about lots of psychiatry diagnoses. Does the fact that I've had this thing make me more likely to have cancer? You know, and I am certainly not aware of a single high quality study that shows that having a personality disorder as a diagnosis is an independent risk factor for developing cancer. And thank goodness for that. But, you know, as you can imagine, that would be really hard to study. There are a lot of confounders to try and weed through. We do know that some thought processes, some behaviors that can be seen in people who meet criteria for personality disorders do impact their cancer journey and how they are involved in it. And those, some of those choices can be linked to negative cancer-related outcomes. We also know some of the frequent comorbidities of personality disorders, things like depression, right, and other anxiety. Those can be linked to negative cancer-related outcomes. And so depression, you know, being like the most well-studied example, is linked to a ton of negative cancer outcomes, including mortality. So when we look at these people as a whole, we want to make sure we're addressing each of those things. But a personality disorder itself is not an independent risk factor.
Well, that's a great way to answer it. No, I appreciate that. You know, it is a thought that comes up, and I think you're highlighting, well, there's no direct relationship, at least as far as we know, but there are some indirect ways in which lifestyle, et cetera, you know, can lead, but not a direct causal relationship for sure. You kind of said something else interesting earlier about how, you know, because I had some questions about, you know, how we kind of make the diagnosis of personality disorder, or like what do we do about it? Like, whether or not there's a personality disorder, how do we approach someone that we feel is struggling, or we're struggling to kind of relate to them, or get a good sense of what they need? I mean, any tips about, I guess this is kind of like the difficult patient, quote unquote, but what do we, you know, now that we have a sense of what we're talking about, like what do we actually do about this?
I think the first key is always to stop and pause and recognize how you're feeling as a provider. As psychiatrists, we get kind of trained to do this, or at least practice it in some sort of environment, but other specialties don't do that quite as much. And it's important to notice that you do sometimes get feelings with some of these patients, right?
Anytime.
And to notice that in yourself, maybe it's helpful diagnostically, but also to take a second to check it, because it may be playing a role in how you interact with the patient or what kind of care you're thinking about delivering. So that's always step one, right? And we want to get supervision or talk to someone if it's feeling like that's really a heightened emotion in the moment. I think the most classic answer you get from psychiatrists, and what you see written in notes all the time, is stuff of like, you want to maintain clear boundaries. Right? You hear that kind of language. And it makes me laugh every time. Even when I write it myself, I laugh because I don't really know what that means a lot of the time. It's not terribly helpful. But what I do think is helpful to how I think we think about boundaries is really about making sure we're providing really consistent structure in our interactions, right? And that structure should be meant to help guide the expectations for how we're all going to come together, the patient and the members of the team, to work towards the common goal of wellness, you know, maybe more specifically other things depending on what you do. And so we're working on making sure we're establishing what's expected from the patient, but also they can expect from us. And once that framework is in place, it's a lot more helpful. And when things feel like they're kind of spiraling out, or we're going down a path that's less helpful, we can use that framework to get back on track again. And oncologists do this to some degree, right? We do this practically already. If you just think about things like plans for how frequently you're going to see patients, that's inherently setting some boundaries and some structure. We may have to be more intentional about some of those practical boundaries, though, in folks who push them or who need different kinds of support. So we may be more intentional about how often we see them, how long the visit's going to be, because they may want it to be longer than it is, right? How you're going to handle it if they don't come, if they no-show frequently, or they come but they come hours late every time, and how what are the boundaries around that going to be? What if they call a lot between appointments? What if they need care in between appointments? Where do you want them to go for urgent care? What do you want that to look like? What happens if they lose their medicine? Right? All these kinds of practical frameworks we can put in place before there are challenges to it, so we can come back to that later.
I love your answer. No, it's a great answer. I think it's spot on, and you know, it makes me think. You know, when in the oncology setting, I think what's difficult about this is that, you know, it's one thing if, like, let's say you're in a kind of psychiatry clinic and you're kind of very clear on your boundaries and you can do that, right? But we're in a situation where patients are sick and there's crises and stuff. And so what's challenging is that it's often appropriate for us to kind of be a little more flexible with our boundaries, you know? And so when you're dealing with a patient who knows how to kind of get in there, or be kind of manipulative with those things, or work the system in a certain way, it creates an uncomfortable feeling. And I think what the big thing I love about what you said was stopping and thinking about your response and thinking about your feeling. Because there are ways, and particularly, and people do this sort of thing not really consciously, but they're going to elicit certain responses, and actually they know those responses are coming, to use that kind of colloquial flip the script kind of thing. But that's really what we do. You know, we kind of stop and we don't give them what they're expecting, which is maybe someone being angry at the other end. And I think that can often really, it shows them that they're dealing with someone who's on a different level, is more mature, who knows themselves, who knows how to handle these things. And if you think about these kind of behaviors that, don't work well in the clinic, I kind of think of it like, man, they might be just coming from a place of fear. They're doing something that they might normally do because this is what they do. Personally, I've always been most impressed with myself when I don't respond the way that I would normally respond. Like, I've noticed, okay, Daniel, if you just think about what you're going to do, and maybe try it a different way, and then you sort of see what happens and how it plays out. Because one of the things about these personality disorders is that they may be kind of falling into like a pattern of behavior that's very typical for them, like when they're under stress, like this is what they do. So we have this wonderful opportunity to kind of change that. And one of the things I think is so challenging is like when we feel like, okay, boy, I'm being manipulated, or something's going on here that I don't really understand, it creates anger. I mean, frankly, it can create some really adverse feelings. And the super important thing is to not act those things out. And that, so more than anything, like that in and of itself, of just not doing that, is kind of addressing this, you know, interaction, this dynamic that may be kind of unfolding. And so like taking the higher ground, you know,
as a provider to take the advice you give patients, you can say,
yeah,
like,
exactly,
wow, you know what you just said surprised me. And I want to make sure I like take a moment to think through that clearly. What if I come back in 15 minutes and we continue the conversation then, and step away and like take a second to really collect yourself and think about what happened. I think this is why it's important, though, to, you want to have consistency in providers as much as you can, even when that feels really hard, especially when we're talking about patients that are more challenging, right? I put this in air quotes if you can't see me, but one of the instincts is to have someone else take over, right? When it's a really difficult, especially if there's lots of anger. And so these tend to be patients where like maybe every year they get a new resident in clinic, or every day a new nurse gets assigned in the inpatient setting. But consistency actually allows to establish rapport and trust and show that you're going to stick with them through these challenging moments. And it actually helps people engage, and it decreases the risk for iatrogenic injuries from care they didn't necessarily need in the future. And then the collaboration amongst those providers becomes the next big important thing. We want to really collaborate to the extreme so that we are sure that we're all on the same page. The risk for miscommunications is lower. The chance for splitting, right? We use that word with personality disorders a lot, are decreased. So they all have the same message and that same framework. And then we document it. So the weeknight and overnight teams, you know, can all be involved and following that same script.
You know, one of the things that you said in there, but you said it quickly, so I'm gonna say it not quickly now, which is that, you know, people should feel, oncologists and their teams and clinicians should feel empowered to see patients more frequently if they feel like they need to. And I think one of the things, especially with oncologists and APPs, and you mentioned it, like, you know, we're seeing, you know, more and more patients are seeing more and more providers, and different folks are kind of stepping in for patients with these kinds of personality styles and whatnot. That can be really like not a great thing. And so just, you know, that in and of itself, because sometimes it's not clear, like I could see where, you know, you may or may not think that that's necessary, or kind of say, yeah, I don't really want to do that. But it would go with your gut, and if you think it's important, you would do it. I would say that, like me as an oncologist psychiatrist, that's one maneuver I do all the time, is to see people more frequently than I would otherwise when I know that they will benefit and need it. And they can be actually very quick appointments sometimes. It can just be like, we're going to just touch base 10 minutes. Let's do multiple time points. Yeah, I mean, it's simple, but it's really, really an effective and good thing. And it also shows, you know, one of the things with this is I always think of it as like you're kind of managing a relationship. And this is a relationship with a patient that's going to be a little bit challenging. So you're going to do things if you're thinking about it and you realize it needs to be done, do it. You know, part of your care is maintaining that relationship. And often it's like you said, less is more. Sometimes it's just about knowing the boundaries, communicating the boundaries. And within all of that context, we've got to find something we really, truly cherish and think is valuable and inherently just a good thing about that patient. Because you want to like all your patients. It's better when you like them. And there's always something. There's always something likable about every person.
Absolutely.
Not to be too, you know, Pollyanna, but there really is. There's got to be something out there.
Well, and I think, you know, people's underneath it all, people's goals and people's fears, you know, those are all the same, right? They're just coming out in different ways and maybe to different levels at different times. But underneath it, it's the same stuff. We just have to understand what's the driver for an individual person. And that may be what some of the negative things that drive it, and it may be the positive things we're trying to drive too. It's all in the mix.
It's all in the mix. Kalina, I want to say that this has been an absolute pleasure talking to you. I've really enjoyed our conversation, and I hope that our listeners have enjoyed it too, and you've gotten some tips on how to interact and work with your patients. And so thank you. Just heartfelt.
Thank you. It was great. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Oncology on the Go podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere podcasts are available. Or listen online at cancernetwork.com/resources/podcasts. The Oncology on the Go podcast is the official podcast of cancernetwork.com, the home of the journal Oncology. For more information, visit us at cancernetwork.com and find us on X, Instagram, and Facebook at Cancer Network without the O, or on LinkedIn at Cancer Network.